If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Before we get started, we want to tell you a bit about the sponsor of this week's History Extra podcast, Warner Hotels. If you're looking to escape to a picturesque corner of the UK for a few days, Warner Hotels has just the thing for you. Each hotel offers everything you could possibly need for the perfect weekend away. From unrivaled leisure facilities and inspiring live entertainment to delicious dining experiences and plenty of history for you to uncover. If this sounds like your kind of getaway, Warner Hotels is now offering a series of exciting weekend packages in 2024. Each three-night stay is at one of three historic hotels, with dinner, bed and breakfast included, plus a whole itinerary of fascinating talks and Q&As with a selection of BBC history experts, such as Tracy Borman, Susanna Lipscomb and James Holland. So what are you waiting for? Book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. From etchings scratched into the earliest monuments to the spray can designs that appear on structures today, the urge to leave our mark is universal. But in 18th century Britain, the nature of graffiti changed, both exploding in popularity and becoming much more radical in nature. In her new book, Writing on the Wall, Madeleine Pelling explores this shift by looking at often moving stories that have been carried through history by the smallest of scratches and notes. Madeleine was speaking to Eleanor Evans, and please be aware that this episode contains some descriptions of violence and suicide.
We are talking today about what we now know as graffiti, people leaving a mark on surfaces, perhaps messages or symbols, and specifically in the long 18th century, from around the reigns of William and Mary to the Georgians. I'm joined by Madeleine Pelling, and perhaps our listeners have their own ideas of graffiti, Maddie, and what this means. Can you take us into broadly the types of mark making your book is covering, and what's happening to it in this period?
Hi, Eleanor. Yes, graffiti massively changes in the 18th century, and I think really we have a very set idea today of what graffiti is, and hopefully the book challenges that a little bit. So today, our relationship with graffiti is quite contradictory. We have, on the one hand, this idea of it being illegal. It's something potentially undesirable in the urban landscape. It's something that a town council will come and wash away or scratch off or cover up in some way. And you can actually face prison time and quite hefty fines for damage to property. But on the other hand, we have street artists like Banksy. We have huge commercial value placed on these works. So we have a sort of strange, very contradictory relationship with it. But for most of human history, really up until the early modern period, at least in Europe, there was a sense of graffiti being instead part of everyday life. It was something that everyone partook in. everyone would do in their own homes, in churches. So in the medieval period in Britain, we would have everyone from the priest down to the lowliest, poorest member of the parish leaving a mark. Things like carved crosses, other Christian symbols, merchants' marks, things that were versions or iterations of those people's individual and sort of community beliefs. You know, leaving your merchant's mark, you might be sealing some kind of business deal, for example. And often we find these in the porches of churches and around columns inside and that kind of thing. So it's something that's always been there. People have always wanted to leave their mark. And there's a real sort of human urge from the very first cave paintings, really, to do that. And my book is interested in when this change happened, when we went from this everyday practice, something that was spiritual, that was sometimes superstitious. A lot of marks in the medieval period are intended to keep away evil spirits or the devil. And when we then shifted to graffiti being something understood in terms of rebellion, in terms of social trouble, political turmoil. And my book pinpoints this transition, this revolution, really, in the moment of the 18th century, the long 18th century. So my book kind of runs, as you very astutely said, really from the end of the 17th century into the early 1800s. And during this period, the graffiti that was made by the inhabitants of Britain and some of its enemies on these shores really changed our understanding of what mark making can do, the power that it can have, the implications it can have, and the very real world effects of it.
So that's a great introduction to situate us into the impact that graffiti could have and the impact on graffiti itself in this era. If we can go to the beginning of the period you're looking at, what are some of the societal shifts in the aftermath of the so-called Glorious Revolution that are perhaps changing how people are making their marks?
Graffiti's revolution really comes with all kinds of social change, and it very much goes hand in hand with it. It reflects that change, but it also drives it a lot of the time. So we have things like increased literacy rates. So more people can read and write and are therefore leaving their mark not only on paper, but also on walls, on windows, on pieces of furniture. And more people feel that they have a voice, that they're able to voice their concerns, their desires, their frustrations with society. There's also huge building programs taking place. We have in the 17th century, of course, famously, the Great Fire of London, which wipes out a huge part of that city. And from the late 17th century going into the early 18th century, there's huge efforts to rebuild the city, this time not in wood, but in stone. And as part of that, people are finding new surfaces to write on like never before. As I've mentioned there, the printing press is a huge moment, a huge implication for this period. And it's something that really explodes in the 18th century. The 18th century is, I think it's fair to say, the wordiest of centuries. It's the time when people are taking to print, and not just printed words, but also printed images, to debate everything from questions of civil rights and liberty to how knowledge is formed, to ideas of order and rationality in the world. And on the one hand, graffiti becomes part of that conversation, that broad conversation of writing, of words, of discussion, of debate. But it also offers something slightly different. Print media throughout the 18th century at various moments is subject to different kinds of censorship, and you could be punished, you could be arrested, you could be socially ostracized for words that you set into print. But graffiti, on the other hand, goes relatively uncensored. It's something that offers anonymity. You can very performatively leave your piece of graffiti in view of everyone, but you can also write it in secret in the dead of night or down an empty alleyway. And so people were able to really express controversial and really quite explosive ideas through that as the century changed and as people's ideas of who they were, what this nation was going to do in the world, across its empire. As those questions were sort of coming to the fore, graffiti helped to crystallise that, I think.
So you've touched on it a fair bit here, but I guess for our listeners, we should perhaps emphasise the importance of the range of people it's giving a voice to in sort of a new light. Can you talk about that aspect of it? Who are we finding this graffiti from?
A huge, huge range. I mean, as I say, in the medieval and early period before this point, everyone in local parishes, local communities, is able to leave their mark as long as you have an instrument with which to do it, a knife, a compass, something like that. But in the 18th century, we see explosion of this, really, an expansion of the people who are involved. So we have everyone from sailors and soldiers who are leaving their marks in military barracks, aboard ships, in colonial outposts that they're sent to around the world. We see sex workers leaving their mark and their clients in brothels, on the windows of brothels and taverns around areas like Covent Garden in London. Or we see people part of fashionable society on the marriage market in Bath, leaving notes to lovers, leaving little witty poems about the sort of sexual tension of some of those interactions. And they write their graffiti on the windows of the assembly rooms, for example, or taverns and rooms that they're renting there. We see political agitators use graffiti. We see children leaving huge amounts of graffiti. And some of it as rude and basic as you would maybe find on the street today. You know, we're no different in that regard. There's a lot of genitalia drawn by children in the 18th century. There's, a really sort of huge, diverse range. And what it gives us is the voices of everyone in 18th century society. It allows us to reconstruct ideas that these people had about themselves, how they fitted into that society, what they hoped for themselves, what their ambitions were, who they hated, who they loved, who they were sleeping with, who they envied. And it really gives us almost a 360 vision of the 18th century world. It's really remarkable. But of course, one of the challenges of working with graffiti is that not all of it survives today. So the graffiti that we have might be left carved into the walls of country houses or cathedrals, but also it exists in the archive. So a lot of people in the 18th century, and this is part of this change that we see happening, a lot of people decide to write down the graffiti that they're seeing. And this is a massive, massive change in terms of how it's understood. Up to this point, no one's really paid that much attention to it. It's part of everyday life. It's normal. It's not particularly noteworthy. And in the 18th century, because it's giving voice to so many different people, and people a lot of the time who don't have power in society elsewhere, they're not appearing in print, they're not appearing at high-level social gatherings, they don't have a say in political policy. Because of that, people start to pay attention to it. They see it maybe as a threat to the established order of things. And so people noted it down in their diaries when they saw graffiti. They would even write it in print. There's a very famous volume called The Merry Thought or Glass Window and Boghouse Miscellany, which is published in 1731. And it's an anonymous work whose author goes around, first of all, London and then around British towns and cities, writing down the graffiti that he or she sees and setting it to print. And it becomes a bestseller because people are so interested in what these voices can tell us then. And obviously for historians, what they can tell us now is absolutely invaluable.
Time for another quick chat about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you want to get away in 2024, why not book a weekend package at one of Warner's most historic hotels? There's Littlecote House, which is a stunning Tudor manor in Hungerford. Studley Castle, a beautiful 19th century building in Warwickshire. Or Home Lacey, a huge Herefordshire mansion that was once visited by Charles I. Whichever location you choose, you'll be able to enjoy a whole weekend of live talks from your favourite historians during your stay. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Can you talk a little bit more about how that graffiti might have been impacted or evolved since the writing of this miscellany?
So the graffiti that we see in the Boghouse miscellany is very much, it's playful. It's mostly written in rhyming couplets. And we have to take it with a slight pinch of salt. You know, this is something that's intended to be sold to a reading audience for sort of humorous consumption. And therefore, we can maybe suggest that some of the graffiti have been edited, if not made up entirely. What it tells us is that graffiti was a little bit like 18th century Twitter. So you get this phenomenon, for example, called underwriting, where in taverns in particular, you would get someone leaving a note either written in pencil on the wall or chalk sometimes carved into a surface. And then someone underneath would reply to that. And then someone underneath would reply to that. And it becomes almost like a thread. And there's a sense people want to contribute their voice. They want to keep the conversation going. As the century goes on, that shifts slightly. So by the mid-18th century, we start to get graffiti really playing into the political life of the nation. And we get political agitators using graffiti almost as a warning. It's a code hidden in plain sight. So, for example, in the 1760s and 1770s, we get the populist MP John Wilkes, who's a really divisive figure. He's really anti-establishment. He's anti-government. He even criticises the king at the time. And his supporters leave the number 45 written on things. This is a reference to the 45th issue published of his newspaper, The North Briton, in which he attacks the king and the government, the Prime Minister, John Bute. And what happens with this graffiti is it spreads as the support for Wilkes spreads. And it becomes a real problem. And people even seek to destroy the graffiti when they see it. We have instances of the 45 being written on carriage doors, and then servants will hurriedly wash it off because they've been inadvertently taking this message across the city. We see the 45 carved into the door of a magistrate, and two of the young men who are caught doing that are prosecuted for it. Interestingly, not for the act of graffitiing itself, but for the content of the message. And we see it again in the Gordon riots in the 1780s, when Britain comes, I think, the closest it ever has to revolution over the course of a week. What starts as a peaceful protest against government bill giving rights to Catholics becomes absolute chaos. Catholic homes are attacked, Catholic schools, furniture is emptied out into the street and set alight in huge bonfires. And by the end of the week, the Bank of England has been attacked. Newgate Prison's been emptied of all its prisoners. And there are British army troops on the ground in London, and they fire on the protesters. And in that context, graffiti that is anti-Catholic, part of this protest against the government bill, evolves over the course of several days and spreads the panic to begin with, spreads the violence, is used initially to indicate which Catholic houses should be attacked by the mob. But later on, the victims of these riots work out that if they put that graffiti near them, they can misdirect the same crowd away from their home. They can use it as a disguise and say, "We agree with your ideas. Go over to that street and you'll find the people that you're looking for." And so graffiti becomes, towards the end of the 18th century, something that's been increasingly used not only to be part of a public conversation and debate that has some humour and some generosity to it, but it becomes a weapon. It's something that is weaponized on all sides of the political spectrum, and it can cause real disaster in real time.
Those are some really great examples of how graffiti can influence and has influenced these mass movements of revolution, of social change, of subversive activities. Your book also includes some really fascinating examples of single moments of graffiti impacting the life of a single individual. We've spoken about zeroing in a little on the story of Mary Aubrey. Could we turn to her story?
Absolutely. It's an incredible story. So one of the great things that studying graffiti gives you is insight into individual lives and often lives that have been otherwise lost from the historical record. And it gives you a real proximity to the past. And one of the stories that I came across is the story of Mary Aubrey. She is a Catholic midwife and a French immigrant living in London right at the beginning of this period in the 1680s, in 1688. She is embroiled in a really gruesome crime and she's caught out as the perpetrator of this crime because of a piece of graffiti. So she's living in London, she's working as a midwife, and she is a married woman. She has a French husband called Denis. Far as I can tell, and it's very difficult to trace people from the lower classes in this period, he seems to be working in some kind of merchant trade. He spends a lot of time travelling between London and France. Whenever he comes back to London to live with her, he is often drunk and he's physically abusive to her. He beats her, he sexually assaults her. And one night, he does this to such an extent that when he falls asleep afterwards, she unties the string that's holding up his garter around his leg and she strangles him with it. And within a few minutes, he's dead. Now, the first thing that she does is panic and she pours herself a brandy, and I think that's fair enough. And then she has to deal with the body, and she doesn't want to obviously get caught for this crime. Because she's a midwife, she has all the tools of her trade at her disposal. And so she actually chops him up. She cuts off his arms and legs and his head, and she takes these parts and the torso that's left over and hides them around London. And interestingly, she puts them into the public privies. The body parts inevitably start to be discovered. And what's so interesting about this story is, even though it is really domestic in scale, there is national panic that ensues from it. This is a time when there's fear of foreigners in London, especially fear of Catholics. There's discussion that the king himself may have converted to Catholicism. There's huge religious and political tension. And these body parts of a man start appearing around the city, and rumours immediately spread that there's a Catholic plot and that spies are in the city ready to take down the establishment and to take over. And Mary, within all of this chaos, is just trying to go about her life and not get caught. And she continues her work as a midwife. And one of her husband, Denise's colleagues, who works going back and forth to France with him, comes to the rooms that they've been renting and finds that Denis is not in. He's come to offer him work. They have a new job to go back to France. And when he finds that Denis is not in, he takes a piece of chalk out of his pocket, which was not unusual. People carried chalk for all kinds of reasons, to mark up things. If you're playing cards in a tavern, you might keep score, for example, on the wall. And there's lots of examples of people starting tavern brawls because someone smudged the scorekeeping and lost the record of who's winning. So he takes the chalk out of his pocket and he writes just an everyday note. We don't know the contents of it, but the gist of it from this man's later witness statement is that he says he's come by Denis and Mary's house, that they weren't in, that he's looking for Denis. Could Denis meet him at a Catholic chapel around the corner tomorrow? So Mary gets home from her midwifery. She finds this note on the door and she decides to answer it instead of Denis. So she turns up the next day at the chapel, and his friend is really confused by this and he's sort of suspicious. She gives him this story that Denis has maybe gone away to the West Indies. She changes the story a couple of times and he becomes really worried that something has happened to his friend and colleague. And eventually the body parts that have been found are put in a local pub, a local tavern, and laid out so that people can come and identify them. And Mary may have got away with it had she not answered this note and sparked this worry in Denis's friend, because when he hears about the body being found, he puts two and two together and he starts to worry that it is, in fact, his friend Denis. He goes to see the body and he identifies it by a scar on the arm. The head at this point has not been found. It's later found in a toilet 2 weeks after it's been put there. And quite how useful it was in identifying him, I think it's fair to say it probably wasn't very. So Mary is accused of the crime. There's an incredible pamphlet that was published publicly, which included all the witness statements that the prosecution took, including one of the men who'd left the graffiti. And she's convicted of the crime. She actually confesses to it immediately. They try and implicate one of her young children in the crime. And so she takes the fall for it to try and save him. And she's burned at the stake for her crime.
It's a grisly tale, a tragic one for sure, but a fascinating example of how these notes, these graffiti could seriously impact the lives of many people on such an individual level. And there's plenty more in your book. And I wanted to pick up on something that you just mentioned there. You mentioned chalk, people mark making with chalk. You've sort of mentioned people scratching notes or symbols into timber or stone, glass even on windows. Can we talk a little bit more about how these marks were made, the various ways?
Absolutely. So what exactly is graffiti? It's a really difficult question to answer. Today, we might think of works that have been made with a spray can, but actually in the 18th century, there's huge variety, not only of the surfaces on which marks are left, but also the ways that those marks are made. And something that I sort of toy with a little bit in the book is what makes graffiti graffiti. Is it the surface on which it's written, the location of the message? Is it the contents of the words themselves and their meaning? And of course, the other very complex thing is that the word graffiti itself doesn't come into play until the mid-19th century, when archaeologists are excavating the ancient city of Pompeii. And they find the Roman graffiti left on the walls there. And that's the name that they give to it when they're trying to interpret those findings. So the 18th century language around mark making is hugely vague. It's hugely varied. There are words like hieroglyph, glyph, wall writing, diary writing, confession. All of these terms are used. And I think what it does is really reflect the absolute variety. So as you say, we have messages written in chalk. This was something that most people would have access to. A lot of men and women carried sharp implements, things like scissors, needles, knives, that could be used to carve into surfaces. One of my absolute favourites in this period is diamond writing. Now, this is graffiti that's most often left on glass using a diamond, a sharpened diamond point. This would be maybe a diamond ring that had been sharpened, or sometimes a diamond pen. Now, we have a diamond pen surviving from this period, at least one, that used to belong to the poet Robert Burns. And Burns was a prolific graffitist. We think of him today as the Scottish bard and as a prolific writer, a poet, someone who set his words to paper, but he was always setting his words to windows as well, particularly, it has to be said, tavern windows after a few drinks. And one of my favourite stories about Burns that I came across in my research was that when he was a young man, he was growing up in the wake of the Jacobite revolutions, the Jacobite risings, and he harboured sympathies for that years later, sort of anti-Georgian, anti-Hanoverian sympathies. And as a young man, he'd had a few drinks in his local pub and took to the window to write an anti-Hanoverian message, something that was mocking King George. And much later in his life, he actually worked as a government official for the Hanoverians. And he was so worried that he would get caught out because of this poem, which was still in place in a pub and very clearly in his hand, that he actually went back to the pub and smashed the window to try and cover up his tracks. So graffiti writing like that, we see there's such variety, but there was real power in it as well. And the fact that everyone could partake in them to a certain extent, okay, not everyone could write with a diamond on the window, but people could leave their marks. We find people leaving their marks in blood and even in excrement, by the way, in the 18th century. So there really were all kinds of tools available to people if you were prepared to be creative. And there's a sense that there was real power in that and real excitement.
I mean, I know what I'd prefer between a diamond and excrement. I think I know what I'd choose. And I think from what you've been saying, it's obviously these marks are so tied up in identity, in the need for people to make these messages known, to leave something of themselves there. A story that really brings this out in your book is the story of a mysterious death in Bristol.
Yeah, so this story comes towards the end of the 18th century in the 1790s. So right at the opposite end of the Mary Aubrey tale. And I have to say, of all the individual stories that I've uncovered during the writing of this book, this is one that's really stayed with me. It's really haunted me, I think it's fair to say. So in 1797, in Sea Mills, which at the time was a little harbour along the Bristol estuary, just outside of the city of Bristol. Today, it's part of the sprawling metropolis that is Bristol City today. And I have been there, actually, and you can go and see this site. In the water there, the body of a young man was found, was discovered drowned, and he was pulled out of the water, and nobody really recognised him in the local area. Nobody could think who he was. He'd been in the water for some time. And there was an advertisement put in the local paper to say, we found this man, we can't identify him. If anyone knows who he is, please come forward and tell us. And that would be the end of that story if it wasn't for a pretty remarkable discovery. So at the harbour, there were a row of tenement buildings which are no longer there, and they were empty even in the 1790s. And a man who was, I suppose, digging for clues, trying to find out what had happened to this young man who died, he went into the building, and when he got to the attic room, he found graffiti on every surface, on every wall, on the floor, on the ceiling, across the whole room. And very quickly it became apparent to him that it was a suicide note. It was the note left by the young man in the water. And quite remarkably, it had a chronology to it. So the young man who died had arrived, I think, 3-4 days before his death. And he'd noted the date each day and the time of day, and he'd given an account of his entire life, leaving out some tantalising details. And he talked about his motivation for taking his own life, the tragic circumstances that had led up to it. And the gentleman who found this note, who discovered it in the tenement building, was so moved by these words left on the wall that he transcribed them all and published them in a pamphlet, printed first in Bristol and then in London later on. And people really took this to heart. It was a really shocking thing to read, and news travelled, and very quickly people were writing to this gentleman saying, I know who this man is. And he was identified as being called James Doe, which is pretty remarkable given that already in the 18th century, as today, we call unidentified bodies John Doe's. It is coincidence. He really was called James Doe, but it's quite a remarkable coincidence. So this James Doe who had died, he was, as far as I can work out, in his mid to late 30s, and the details of his life then start to flood in. He was born in Lambeth and he trained as a Delft pottery decorator. He was a painter who would paint these ceramic wares. And of course, the 18th century witnesses an absolute boom in the ceramic trade, and very soon into his career, James Doe followed the industry all the way up to Staffordshire, to the Staffordshire Potteries, which is where I'm from and where lots of my ancestors worked in the 18th and 19th centuries. So I felt very drawn to this story. And James Doe's story is really remarkable. He works at the factory of Josiah Wedgwood, and he witnesses huge change, including food riots when food is scarce in Staffordshire, as it was across the whole of the north of England. And he was potentially involved in a moment of industrial espionage. Now, potteries in the 18th century, there was formal training schemes where apprentices, usually young boys, would be taken on and taught by the master potters. And each pottery would have its own chemical way of working, its own understanding of the production process. And these were secrets that were really carefully guarded. And to go from one factory to another was really a betrayal of the master potter that had trained you. And so it was very important to try and retain your workers. And James Doe, of course, we know about him that he was a very skilled painter. So he would have been a highly valued member of Wedgwood's factory. Now, in his suicide note that he left in Bristol, he talks about a great betrayal where a friend of his at Wedgwood's factory, as far as I can tell, and this is a real mystery that's been pieced together, it seems that he betrayed the factory and Wedgwood by trying to sell some of the designs to a French company who were competing at the time. And he's actually sent to prison for this. But James Doe, he says in his note on the wall, loved his friends so much. And there seems to be real deep love, whether that's a sexual love, whether that's just friendship. It's really very difficult to unpick that now with this historical distance. But he spent all of his money and time and energy into maintaining this friend in prison, making sure he had food, keeping his spirits up. And when this gentleman comes out, James Doe himself has been pushed to the bottom of the heap. He's had to leave the Wedgwood factory. He's been a vagrant, moving around across Britain and Ireland looking for work. He's no longer working using the skills that he has. And this friend comes out of prison and doesn't help him and pretends not to know him. And Doe is so broken by this that he finds himself in Bristol, eventually working in a really low-grade pottery factory. And this is the moment that he takes his life. And it's such a remarkable story of one man who, again, would very much have disappeared from the historical record. And he's really difficult to find in the Wedgwood archive. I've spent a lot of time and spoken to the brilliant archivist there, and we can't find a trace of him because he just wasn't important enough to be mentioned, I suppose. So all we have of him is this suicide note and his life account in his own words in a really desperate, dark moment. But what was so interesting in the 1790s is that his note carried such weight that people were so moved by this to see in the age of romanticism, when people are thinking about big sweeping landscapes and art as this big elevated thing, to see an industrial worker, someone from the working classes, expressing feelings that in popular culture at the time were really understood to be felt by, you know, the highest poets in the land, the Wordsworths, the Coleridges of the 18th century, that to have that humanising voice given by someone so lowly was really shocking and really remarkable. And it was a story worth telling then, and it's a story worth telling now.
Yes, it's such a fascinating story, as you said, really, really haunting, and an example of the power of those notes scribbled, those words that might seem small in the historical record are clearly so important. I wonder if we can begin to sort of end this period you're talking about by, I'd like to ask, when do we sort of see the nature of how graffiti is perceived changing? When does it sort of start to move towards the more illicit, potentially the social connotations of graffiti we might see today?
So certainly by the 1790s and the moment when James Doe dies, there is a feeling that graffiti has, in the at least two or three decades before that, caused real civil unrest. We've seen it, as I say, in the Gordon riots. We've seen it with supporters of John Wilkes. We've seen graffiti being present at moments of social unrest at street level. And not only has it been present and reflecting what's happening, but it's been driving those forces and those movements. By the end of the 18th century, there's a real separation that takes place, and it's something that's still in place today, between the marks made in the past and the marks made in the present. And going into the 19th century, the marks made in the present are seen as troubling, as holding dangerous levels of power. And the marks that are left in the past and made in the past and discovered are really given a sort of romantic rehabilitation. So within a few months of James Doe's suicide in Bristol, there's a discovery at the Tower of London, which is probably one of the most famous examples of historic graffiti today. So workmen there in the 1790s are changing part of the tower. They're making it into a mess for officers stationed there. And they're pulling back some wainscoting from the 17th century. And underneath on the walls are the carved messages of Tudor and Elizabethan prisoners who've been held in the tower, including the graffiti left by Lady Jane Grey, supposedly, before her own execution. And in that moment, the marks of the past become palatable. They're dressed up as being sympathetic, humanising, but no longer threatening. Something to be enjoyed, something of our sort of national story. Whereas outside on the streets, a few metres away from the Tower of London, marks that are being made out there are deemed problematic. And so by the 19th century, we start to see people being prosecuted for leaving their marks. people continued to create graffiti well into the 19th century and obviously still do today. They leave their initials, they leave dates in particular, carved into landmarks, into historic sites. But it's perceived more and more as a problem. There's a famous example, I think, in the 1890s, when a gentleman in, I think it's on Orkney, leaves his name carved into a church there, and he is charged by the local magistrate £1 for doing that. And his defence is that Queen Victoria's son, Prince Albert, has actually come and done the same thing a few weeks earlier. But no, it's not acceptable, and he's fined for it. There's a sense very much that going from the Georgian world into the Victorian world, there is a shift. And that shift happens because of all the turmoil in the 18th century, because of this revolution that graffiti undergoes, in which it's able to reflect and give power, give a platform to all kinds of people, many of whom don't have power in society and who people in authority would not wish to give power to. And so by the end of that period, there are moves to try and to quash it, to legislate against it.
It's such a fascinating shift. From what you've been saying, it's clearly such an eternal impulse. And what you just said there about that chap in the 1890s put me in mind of the chap who scratched something into the Colosseum. Was it last year or the year before? I can't quite remember. And, you know, that was obviously widely condemned. But I guess having written this book and considered so many examples from history, do you find yourself considering today's graffiti differently, through different eyes, perhaps?
I think so, yes. And I wouldn't necessarily encourage people to go out and do it. But I do think that the graffiti all around us, whether it is historic or contemporary, can give us an insight into what's going on in the world, how people feel about things, who is calling for change, who is complaining, who is frustrated, who is hoping for something better. A great example of this is the statue of Edward Colston that was pulled down in 2020 in Bristol during the Black Lives Matter protest there. And not only was the statue pulled down, but he was graffitied with red spray paint saying Black Lives Matter on it. And when the statue later on went on display in Bristol's M Shed Gallery, the graffiti wasn't removed. Curators took the decision not to remove the graffiti from the statue. And there was real uproar about this, and it prompted real debate about whether they should have removed it to better preserve the original artwork or whether it was something that needed to be there. And I think for me, graffiti like that is an additional layer onto history. It's the voices of people being added to the conversation. And I think rather than erasing that and taking it away, I think we need to pay attention to it. There's a fantastic proverb from, I think, the 1640s. It's very, very early, that talks about writing on the wall as being seriously important litmus paper, really, for understanding where its society is at, where we're going to go next. And the proverb says that a white wall, a blank wall, is the paper of a fool. And so I think we need to maybe be aware of graffiti around us, and we actually need to fear its absence. I think the moment where we have completely eradicated those conversations, those voices, that's a moment for real concern.
Okay, and for a final note for perhaps listeners who've heard this, who would want to maybe seek out a bit of graffiti they could find themselves, because as you've mentioned, some are in private residences, they're not all on sort of, you know, National Trust country houses and things. Have you got any tips for listeners who'd like to maybe go on a graffiti hunting journey of their own?
I certainly have, and I think one thing that I will say, preface this with, is by saying beware, listener, because once you start to see graffiti, you see it everywhere and you cannot stop. It is very addictive. The best places to go are English Heritage National Trust properties as a starting point. And both of those institutions have fantastic records and articles about some of the graffiti at their properties on their websites. If you go into any medieval church in Britain, the likelihood is that if you search hard enough, you will find some writing on the wall. There are really fantastic volunteer groups up and down the country who are dedicated to recording a lot of this, you know, medieval stuff, but also early modern 18th, 19th century graffiti. They're doing hugely important things to create databases of marks that have not been recorded anywhere else. It's a really exciting moment for graffiti. There's huge growing interest. There's been interest for decades in the archaeology community, but it's something that historians are becoming more and more interested in. So yes, get out there and have a look, and I guarantee you will find some.
That was Madeline Pelling. Her book, Writing on the Wall, Graffiti, Rebellion, and the Making of 18th Century Britain, is published by Profile and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.
Before you go, one final word about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you fancy a break in 2024, you can now choose from three fantastic weekend packages at some of the most historic Warner Hotels. For instance, Little Coat House is set in a stunning location in Hungerford, which has played host to Romans, a civil war army, and the planning of the D-Day landings. Meanwhile, Studley Castle in Warwickshire was used as a training camp for the Women's Land Army during the World Wars. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.